Chapter 28. The Road to Trivandrum. Satyapriya had estimated that, travelling by easy stages and allowing time to visit places of religious importance on the way, it might take us 2 years to reach the Himalayas. Such a prospect we did not find in the least daunting. With the open road before us, and the consciousness that our life as wandering ascetics had at last truly begun, we were in fact both in a highly elated mood. The period of false starts and delays was over. We now had a definite objective, the attainment of which was only a matter of time. This knowledge gave fresh meaning to our existence, directing all our energies into a single channel, and adding, as it were, wings to our feet. For the first hour the going was pleasant enough, but as the sun ascended we began to feel hot and tired. Our bundles, so small and light to the eye that morning, felt heavy as lead, and for the first time in my life I wished that I possessed fewer books. When my arm started aching, I slung the bundle over my shoulder, and when the heavy bamboo began chafing my collarbone, I transferred the ever-weightier bundle, now to my right hand, now to my left. As with each change of position, my arm started aching, and my collarbone paining me more quickly than before, I was soon shifting the bundle every few minutes. Meanwhile, my feet had blistered, and I started to limp. Satyapriya, though stronger and sturdier than I, was also feeling the strain. In this sorry state, we entered our first village. It had been our intention to allow ourselves a short rest, but as we plodded wearily past the single row of mean huts, the inhabitants, who from their dress we recognized as Muslims, shouted and jeered at us with such obvious ill nature that we did not stop. Late that night we staggered into the town of Nagarkoil. In the public hall at Nagarkoil, as in the library at Cape Comorin, we awoke beneath the dark-ringed eyes of Sir C.P., whose picture occupied the place of honour here also. They greeted us every morning for a week, for in Nagarkoil we made numerous friends, some of whom not only invited us to their houses, but made arrangements for me to deliver, in the same hall, a series of lectures on Indian philosophy and religion. Yet the town must have been less interesting than Cape Comorin, for, like the frescoes of a ruined temple, which, after centuries of exposure to the elements, there remains but half a pensive face, a fragment of upraised arm, a patch of darker background. Whatever impressions I had of it have long since faded. My most vivid recollection is of having my blistered foot attended to in the dispensary, as a doctor's surgery is called in India, of a medical practitioner who was attending the lectures. Nagarkoil, though falling within predominantly Malayalam-speaking Travancore, was a Tamil-speaking town, and we were not in it many days before becoming aware that there existed throughout the state a strong feeling of hostility between the two groups, the Tamils, who originally hailed from Madras, being regarded by the Malayali majority as interlopers and aliens. Antagonism between Brahmins and non-Brahmins was also pronounced. Like most South Indian towns, Nagarkoil had its Brahmin street, and my second most vivid recollection is of being taken to view this sociological curiosity. Undeniably, it was the neatest and cleanest street in town, and the most picturesque. The fronts of the tiny houses were painted with red and white vertical stripes like a temple, Brahmins being considered gods on earth, while the broad, cow-dung-smeared space in front of each door was covered with an astonishing variety of delicately beautiful geometrical designs, executed in a white paste made from powdered rice. Until recent times, we are told, non-Brahmins were prohibited by law from passing through this street, and though the legal sanction had been withdrawn, so strong was the force of religious tradition that, with few exceptions, non-Brahmins even now continued scrupulously to respect this absurd prohibition. In Suchindram, halfway between Nagarkoil and Trivandrum, we spent only 1 or 2 days. Much smaller, older, and quieter than Nagarkoil, it was a curiously lifeless place. Bathing in the deep green waters at the bottom of an ancient stone tank, from whose crumbling sides grew tufts of grass and small bushes, we felt alone in a noiseless world. Most of the afternoon was spent exploring the adjacent temple, a fine old building where, in a kind of cloister, from which opened several small chapels, we discovered stone slabs bearing inscriptions in archaic characters. Against the pillars stood life-size female figures who cupped their hands against protuberant breasts to make receptacles for the oil in which lighted wicks were placed at night. We also discovered several multiple columns, polished to such smoothness that it felt as if one was fingering human flesh. When struck, their different sections emitted various musical notes. In ancient times, we are told, a Devadasi would dance from the temple gates up through the hall between these columns to the doors of the sanctuary. As they could be played upon like a musical instrument, the accompaniment would be taken up on each pair of columns as she passed between, so that the dancer seemed to be carrying the music with her as she advanced. Both music and dance were, of course, for the entertainment of the deity living in the temple. Who this was, I have forgotten. Probably it was a goddess. But I remember we were told by the same informant that she was famous throughout South India for her enormous appetite. 40 maunds, or more than 1.5 tons, of rice were cooked every day and ritually offered to her. The Ramakrishna Mission literature I had read, and Swami friends with whom I discussed the subject, emphasized that no Hindu worshipped images. Images were merely symbols of the Absolute. Both, following Swami Vivekananda, pointed out to the ignorant Westerner that the Hindu's respect for an image was analogous to a son's respect for his father's picture, and that only the most ignorant confused the symbol with the thing symbolized. However much this rationalistic explanation may suffice for image worship in certain schools of Buddhism, it is a complete distortion of Hindu beliefs and observances. The image in a Hindu temple, once consecrated, is invariably regarded as a living being. The temple is its personal abode, and the daily ritual worship consists simply in offering it whatever is necessary to life. Like a king, it must be awoken in the morning with music. It must be bathed, clothed, and decorated with flower garlands and jewels. It must be entertained with song and dance, taken for periodical outings, as at Madura, and on ceremonial visits to other gods. Above all, it must be fed. Whenever an image is installed, Brahmin priests perform a prana pratishtha, or life-giving ceremony. Those responsible for the establishment and endowment of the temple are then informed what quantity of cooked food will be required to sustain the life thereby infused into the image. The more jagrat, or awake, it is, the more sustenance must be given. South Indian temples were endowed with vast estates by ancient Hindu kings simply in order to satisfy, out of their produce and revenues, the inordinate appetite of their deities. What really happened to the enormous food offerings we discovered only in Trivandrum. Meanwhile, we continued our journey. This took us to a hill known as Silver Mountain, sacred to Murugam, the ancient Tamil god of war, where we spent 2 days with a Hindu ascetic, and to Padmanabhapuram, the ancient seat of the rulers of Travancore. Of the latter, there remained little more than the old palace, a magnificent structure built entirely of wood. We spent several hours exploring the finely carved chambers. In one stood a couch of black marble for the hot weather, in another 2 full-length silver mirrors, so tarnished that they showed only fragments of our reflections. Most interesting of all was the long, low, first-floor gallery with the so-called elephant windows, through which the monarch used to step onto the back of a tusker waiting in the courtyards below. Other places, too, we visited, but as though in a dream. Eventually, footsore and weary, we reached the capital.